Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Our passage this morning is from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 7, verses 24 to 37, contains not just two more healing stories, but two very challenging healing stories that reveal the explosive and the uncontrollable nature of the gospel. From there he set out and went to the region of Tyre. He entered a house and did not want anyone to know he was there. Yet he could not escape notice. But a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit immediately heard about him, and she came and bowed down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician. She begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. He said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." But she answered him, "Sir, even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. Then he said to her, "For saying that, you may go. The demon has left your daughter." So she went home, found the child lying on a bed, and the demon was gone. Then he returned to the region of Tyre and went by the way of Sidon towards the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis. They brought to him a deaf man who had an impediment in his speech, and they begged him to lay his hand on him. He took him aside in private, away from the crowd, and put his fingers into his ears and spat and touched his tongue. Then, looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, "Ephphatha," that is, "be opened." And immediately his ears were open and his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. Then Jesus ordered them to tell no one. But the more he ordered them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. They were astounded beyond measure, saying, "He has done everything well. He even makes the deaf to hear and the mute to sing." May God bless this reading, and may he bless our hearing of it.
So this past summer, I did a little bit of travel by airplane, where I was reminded that I don't like it very much. I'm not afraid of flying. I don't get sick or nauseous or anything like that. But what I don't like about flying by airplane is that from the second I get to the airport to the second I leave the airport at my destination, my fate is completely in the hands of other people or other things, right? Mechanical problems with the airplane, nothing I can do about that. Super long lines at the security check, nothing I can do to change that. If there are storms that delay or cancel my flight, I guess I'm out of luck. If they lose my baggage and I have to wear the same pair of underwear for 3 days, there's nothing, not a zilch, that I can do about that. So a couple years before Simon was born, Deirdre Owen and I were flying from Seattle back to Burlington. And the carrier that we were using was a small carrier, and they only had two itineraries a day from Seattle to Burlington. So we're driving the 3-hour trip to the airport, and when we get there, we find out that our flight's been delayed due to electrical storms on the East Coast. And by the time we get to the ticket counter in order to rebook onto the next flight, we realize that everyone else on our flight had also rebooked ahead of us. And we were told the bad news. It was going to be, can you believe it, 2 days before they could get us on a flight back to Burlington. So what do you do at that point? I mean, do you tantrum until you either get arrested or they put you onto a plane? Do you rent a car and try to drive across the country? What do you do? So what we did was we took out our credit card and we bought another ticket later in the day on another carrier. And provided that that flight wasn't also canceled, we would get to Boston, rent a car, and then drive with an overtired but still won't go to sleep toddler 4 hours back to Burlington. So that's what we did. And the good news is that it all worked out. The bad news is that it was expensive and time-consuming and absolutely no fun at all. And it left me with a lingering distaste for air travel. Anybody else had this experience before? Yeah, absolutely. So it would have been different if it was our fault in some way, right? You know, like if we had forgotten our ID or lost the tickets or arrived late or something like that. But all of the inconvenience, everything that happened, had nothing to do with us. It wasn't our fault, and it was completely out of our control. And that's the word, right? Control. Control, or at least the illusion of control, is something that you have to give up if you travel by air. And I don't know about you, and I'm not particularly proud to admit this about myself, but giving up control is not something that I'm very good at and not something that I like to do very often. Well, as our story that Don so beautifully read for us today, Jesus is at a point in his ministry where he's healing and he's teaching and he's exciting people. And crowds are following him. They want to connect with him. They want a piece of what he has to offer. So he finds his way to a region called outside the city of Tyre, the vicinity of Tyre. Now, Tyre is a port city on the eastern shore of the Mediterranean, 100 miles north of Jerusalem and spitting distance from Jesus' home turf in Galilee. It's important to know that the Tyrians were very wealthy traders, and they exerted a tremendous amount of power and influence over the region, and were the cause of much suffering of the Jewish people in Jesus' day. So the Tyrians were considered by many Jews to be the enemy, the oppressor, part of the problem. So Jesus is in this region, in this potentially hostile area, but people are excited about him anyway, and they want a piece of him even though they're not Jewish. And so Jesus is tired, and he needs a little bit of respite. We know how that feels. And so he goes into a house. We don't know whose house it was. He goes into this house seeking a little bit of refuge and respite and some time away from the needy crowds, but it doesn't work. They know he's there, and they come and they find him. And one of the people who comes and finds him is a Syrophoenician woman, as Mark tells us, or as Matthew's version of the story tells us. She's a Canaanite woman, but she's not Jewish. And she comes seeking help from Jesus for her daughter who's gravely ill. We don't know her name, but we know that she's very different than Jesus, separated by geography and race and religion and class and gender. She's very different from Jesus, but she comes seeking help anyway. And this is where this story gets really hard, right? Because we would expect Jesus, right, to meet her in her need and to heal her daughter and to make everything okay, to receive her with warm and open arms. But that's not what he does at first, is it? In fact, what he tries to do is to dismiss her based on her race and on her religion. He calls her a dog. There's no way to soften that. I mean, it means what it means. He calls her a dog, and he says, look, you know, I got to give my time and energy to my own people, not to you, the oppressor, someone who's so different than me. You're second class, you're second rate, you don't get a part of me. At first, what Jesus does is he tries to dismiss her in a very harsh way for reasons that are difficult for us to process. Well, she believes in Jesus, and she's got way too much on the line with the health of her daughter to be dismissed so easily, so she pushes, and she argues, and interestingly, she calls him Kyrios, Lord. It's the only time in the Gospel of Mark that anyone calls Jesus Lord, and out of the mouth of the oppressor, nonetheless. Kyrios, Lord, she says, yes, I know I'm a dog, but even the dogs eat the crumbs from the master's table. I'll take whatever you're given, she says, because I believe. It changes Jesus, right? He's walking this way, and he interacts with this stubborn woman, and he turns and goes the other way. He decides to heal the daughter that he didn't want to heal. He decides to welcome her in. And more importantly, I think, not only does he heal the daughter, but for us, I think this story is a place where we see Jesus change. Right? He's opened. He expands his vision and his sense of mission. He has a change of heart and a change of mind. A change of heart and change of mind. Jesus, you're saying, I am the same yesterday, today, and forever. Jesus doesn't change, right? Jesus is in control, right? Jesus, this is all a setup. Just this interaction here is a way to teach her something and to teach us something. It's not about Jesus learning anything. Jesus is in control, right? Well, as Mark puts it together for us, he adds this second story of healing of the deaf-mute man at the end. You see, Jesus, after he heals this daughter and he changes, he moves 25 miles to the south and to the east to a region called the Decapolis. Great word, just means 10 cities. It's a cluster of 10 cities in Galilee. And there he encounters a man who is deaf and mute. And so he heals him, and he says, Ephphatha, he commands him in Aramaic, be open. And the man was open. He could hear and he could speak again, which was amazing and miraculous. And everyone who saw that wanted to go out and tell everyone else about it, except for Jesus wasn't ready for that to happen, right? He was trying to control the story. He wanted them to wait to tell them about him for a little while longer. But keeping a secret like that is really hard to do. And the more that Jesus tries to control the story, the more the story wiggles out of his control. What I think we see in these passages is that the gospel, even for Jesus, is surprising and shocking and erratic and is something that even he can't control. And it changes him as it changes all of us who let it in. So I'll share with you, this is not just another passage for me personally. This is a very important passage for my own spiritual journey. Matthew's version of this story of the Canaanite woman was the preaching text at my ordination service when I was ordained as a minister in the United Church of Christ. And I chose this story because it's hard, because it challenges us, because it shows us a Jesus we don't see a lot of other places. I chose it because it's countercultural and counter-tradition, and counter-church. You see, because in this passage, what we do is we see a Jesus who comes to us, doesn't hover out there, doesn't linger in the heavens, isn't in the shadows somewhere, somehow removed and distant from all of us, but God comes to us in flesh and blood and bone, right there with us, incarnate, in order to have a relationship with us. And in order to have a relationship with us, I think that God knows that what God needs to do is to make it so that everybody involved in the relationship has something to lose. That everyone is vulnerable. Everyone has something to risk. Everyone in it is not only willing to change other people, but is willing to be changed by the other. I think God does this because God knows that in order for us to have a real relationship with God, God's got to be willing to change too. Now, that is not a standard interpretation of the gospel. and it is not a standard interpretation of this passage, but I will tell you that I have spent serious time with this, and this story has fed me, expanded me, Ephatha. I have been opened by it and come to see my God, who I try to follow every single day, who's loving enough and courageous enough and willing to risk being vulnerable with me and with you, willing to come and meet me and have a deep relationship, and willing to not only change me, but to be changed by me as well. So call me a heretic. Maybe you'll fire me. But I see in this passage a counter tradition against the dominant tradition in our gospel that's so very concerned about the idea that God can change. And yet I think this story is telling us that yes, God can and does change, because God wants relationship with us. So this past summer, I did some travel by airplane, and I don't like to travel by air. I don't get sick. I'm not afraid of it at all. It's just that in order to travel by plane, I've got to give up control, and I don't like to do that very much. So this story has reminded me of all of that and reminded me of my own control tendencies and my need to kind of give some time and thought and consideration to that, right? Maybe what I need to do is not to spend less time on airplanes, but more time on airplanes. Maybe I need to learn to fly on gospel airlines. The airline above all the other airlines where there is absolutely no chance that I can control anything at all that goes on there. Right? I know it's risky to fly gospel airlines, right? I know it's dangerous. Mechanical issues, nothing I can do. If a woman who's stubborn and needs healing for her daughter comes to me or to my church and needs help, that might delay me or cause me to open or be different in some way. The gospel airlines might just make me lose control or make me lose my life too, as it did for Jesus. I know it's risky and dangerous to fly gospel air, but it's really okay, because the God I follow every single day flew gospel air and was changed by it and taught me to do the same thing. So welcome aboard, Gospel Airlines. If you need help from a steward or stewardess, just push the button. Amen.
The closing hymn this morning is 366, and the text is